chamber glowed with soft amber light. He pulled a cord that slid a cover over the tiny skylight, leaving only candlelight for illumination. It was high noon outside, but here it was midnight. He made another circuit of the room, pulling open the black velvet drapes. The four windows had been sealed over on the inside. In their place were full-length mirrors. The deep darkness above, the dim light, the mirrors all around, made it impossible to sense the true dimensions of the room. It seemed to expand into infinity, endlessly reflected in the opposing mirrors. I was in his private world now, a place outside of time and space. The effect was very special, secretive and hypnotic, and promising. Michael had imagination. I walked to the middle of the room. I could feel my cock pulsing against my left leg. Michael finished his preparations and stood before me, his face quizzical, his hands at his sides. "Take off your clothes," I said. He looked at me for a moment expressionless. Then he grabbed the bottom seam of his tank top and pulled it over his shoulders. Suddenly I knew who he reminded me of. Lil Abner, the cartoon hillbilly who used to be in the Sunday comics when I was a kid, the exaggerated shoulders and chest, the wasp waist, the bulging thighs and calves. "Yeah," I breathed. "Now your pants." They were so tight he had to peel them off, turning them inside out. His balance never faltered as he bent over and lifted his feet. He was as graceful as a dancer. He stood and slid his fingers under the waistband of the clinging briefs. "Leave those on," I said quietly. I wanted to save the sight of his naked ass for later. His cock was hard, causing a bulge that pulled the waistband an inch from his flat belly. I took my time, trying to stare him down. Michael never lowered his eyes. I could read no expression in them. "Come here," I said. He walked to me slowly. It was breathtaking just to watch him move. Even the simple act of walking he performed with animal grace, fluid and sexual. He stopped a foot away, looming above me. I didn't like his face being above mine. It wouldn't be for long. He raised his right hand to touch the leather band around my left biceps. "You have a beautiful body," he said softly. He brought his hands to my chest and combed his fingers through the thick mat of blonde hair. "Like Carl," he whispered. I grabbed his wrists and pushed his hands to my crotch. "Take it out." He looked down as he unbuttoned my jeans, spread the flaps, and circled his fingers around the thick base of my cock. He had to use both hands to pull it out. He held it tightly. I saw a strange smile on his downturned face. He weighed it in his hands. "Yeah, big and heavy. Just like Carl's." "Then get on your knees and suck it. Just like you suck Carl's cock." Michael knelt. In the mirrors to my left and right, I saw his body lean and sleek in profile. I watched the head of my cock slide between his lips and shuddered at the contact. In the mirror before me, I saw his back-thrust ass inside the translucent briefs. I twisted the hair at the nape of his neck into a single cord and used it to hold his head in place. His back was untouched. Maybe Carl didn't want to see that ivory perfection marred by welts. Michael would find out soon enough where the comparisons ended between Carl and me. I yanked his head forward and gave a sudden thrust with my hips, trying to catch him off guard, start him off gagging, get his saliva running, make him take it my way from the very start. But it slid down his throat without a hitch. I looked down at his upturned face. His eyes were shut. The long lashes flickered. His cheeks were drawn taut. His thick red lips circled the base of my shaft. His jaw was thrust sharply into my balls. His throat was distended, packed with a solid truncheon of flesh. I fucked his face hard and deep, never pulling more than halfway out, watching his throat expand and contract as I pumped into him. The candlelight flashed on the trickles of spit that ran from the corners of his mouth onto his corded neck. I kept expecting him to protest and push me away, gasping for breath, but he seemed resigned to letting me fuck his face as long and as hard as I wanted. I finally pulled his head back by a fistful of hair and emptied his throat with a jerk. Keep him cock-hungry, I thought. He leaned back, gasping. His mouth and chin were wet with spittle. His lips glistened in the firelight. I rested my cock head against his lower lip while he caught his breath. He swallowed hard and spoke in a murmur, moving his wet lips over the knob of my cock head. You must have some toys down in your room. He rolled his eyes up to mine. Yeah, I said, in a wooden locker by my bed. I reached down to gently squeeze his nipple. Be a good boy and go fetch it. While he was gone, I stripped off my jeans. I flexed my upper body and looked at my reflection in the mirrors. Michael had said I had a fine body, a real compliment coming from a man with such an exceptional physique. And why not? I wasn't as tall as he was, or as broad, but I was thicker in the chest, more compact. The years I had spent working off the anxieties of New York through sweat and hard exercise had paid off many times. I liked the difference in our bodies. My deep tan and stark tan line against his pale flesh, the rich golden hair on my chest and limbs against his sleek nudity, the 9-inch column of flesh that stuck up from my crotch and that hard, round ass of his waiting to be split wide open. I pumped my left arm and watched the biceps strain against the studded band. Michael returned. He knelt and placed the long box at my feet. Go ahead, I told him. Open it. If you see something you like, ask for it. He lifted the lid and gazed down at the jumble of steel and leather. He noticed the dozen varieties of tit clamps. He picked up a chain-linked pair and stared at them. You're really into pain, he murmured naively. You like to put these on other men's nipples, twist them, pull on them. A way to put pain in them, make them whimper and beg. Uh-huh, I said dryly, answering his innocent act with a smirk. You got big tits. Probably take 2 clamps each. Michael put the clamps back in the box. Afraid of them, I thought. Good. He took out a pair of padded handcuffs. To bind them, put them at your mercy so they can't strike back, so you can feel free to use them however you want. That's right. I spread my legs and stroked my cock with 2 fingers. It was throbbing at maximum erection, almost achingly hard. He set the cuffs aside on the floor, then took out my pride and joy. My riding crop. An intricately twined handle with a thin 2-foot tongue of stiff leather. It had been a gift from a not very shy trick in the village. It's yours, Bill, he had said, if you'll use it on me. And I had. I was amazed Michael had the nerve to choose it. And you use this on their naked skin as if they were animals. His tone was fascinated but detached, as if he were an observer taking inventory. He really knew how to ask for it. He looked up at me with those deep brown eyes. Is that what you want to do with me, Bill? Cuff my hands behind my back, clamp my nipples, make me crawl after your big cock, beat me, fuck my ass. His deep voice, low and soft, reverberated in my head. I felt the rush of a perfect moment. That's right, Michael. Now hand me the crop. He held it horizontal, offering it with both hands. I took it by the handle and ran the tongue through my fist. I touched the tip against his chest and gently tapped his nipple. Then I drew it up and cracked it across my thigh to make him flinch. But he didn't flinch. Instead, his face seemed to harden, to become steady and purposeful. He rose to his feet and stared down at me. Suddenly, my whole left arm went limp, as if the nerves had been severed. The writing crop slipped from my hand. I didn't hear it hit the floor. I tried to look down and found that I couldn't take my eyes from his. "Stay." His quiet voice boomed deeply in the silence. And I stood, my body relaxed but paralyzed, as he walked to a casket across the room. I couldn't turn my head to watch him. I was forced to stare straight ahead into the mirror. It reflected the fear and astonishment frozen on my face. Michael returned. Several lengths of thin chain were looped over his forearm. He slowly circled me, examining my naked body. I felt like an insect paralyzed in a spider's web waiting to be eaten alive. But I didn't panic. My mind seemed to be slowing down, shifting into neutral, losing touch with reality. I should never have smoked that weed, I thought, then remembered I hadn't. I tried to open my mouth to ask him what the hell he had done to me, but I couldn't speak. My jaw was frozen. He had said he was into some sort of martial art, paralysis with a touch, but he hadn't touched me. There was no way he could have drugged me. He ran his hands over my body, exploring my back and arms, cupping my pecs and buns. He inserted his middle finger into my mouth to wet it and slid it gently up my ass. My mouth stayed open as his finger had left it. He stood beside me and spoke in my ear, keeping his long middle finger inside me, gently probing. He wet his other hand in my mouth and stroked my cock. I watched in the mirror, his lean profile, the rolling muscles in his stroking arm, my mouth left gaping open like an idiot's. "I've been paid $25,000 for what I'm about to do to you, Bill." Stroking, probing. But that was for a man who wanted it, or thought he did. And he wasn't very attractive. You are, Bill. Big cock. Hard ass. He frowned at my chest. All that hair is unfortunate. It hides your muscles. You'll look better after the hoop. He slid his finger from my ass, gave my cock a hard squeeze, and released it. He stood before me and slipped the chains from his forearm. There were two of them, one quite long, the other the length of a bracelet. They were made like dog chokers, with nooses and sliding rings to control the pressure. He put the bigger chain over my head and pulled it tight around my neck. The metal was as cold as ice, unnaturally cold. The loose end hung between my pecs. Then he slid the smaller chain over my cock and balls, circled them tight, and left the end dangling from the underside of my testicles. He bent over and retrieved the padded handcuffs, twisted my arms behind my back, and cuffed my wrists. He stood in front of me and smiled grimly. "And now this," he said, "since symbols are so important to both of us." He unsnapped the leather band from my arm. I felt as if my last protection had been stripped from me. He tried to fit it over his own left biceps, but the muscle was too big. Instead, he slipped it over my right arm and snapped it tight. He stepped aside so I could see myself in the mirror. Naked, cock hard and circled with cold steel, arms bound, choker around my neck, leather strap on the right, marking my subservience. I groaned inside, confused and helpless. In 5 minutes, against my will, he had completely reversed our roles, and I had no idea how he had done it. Then, as fogged as my mind was, I noticed something. I couldn't be certain in the dim light, but the silver chains around my neck and cock seemed to glow faintly, circled by a ghostly blue light. As I watched, the blue aura grew stronger until I saw it clearly in the glass, like wisps of phosphorescent blue mist around my neck and between my legs. I was not afraid, not quite, not yet. A numbness was seeping into my head, a comfortable sense of detachment. Damn it, I thought. Maybe he slipped me a drug of some kind. But I knew somehow that the chilly numbness wasn't in my head. It was radiating from those cold blue chains. Michael returned. With both hands he held what looked like a hoop of glass tubing, 2 feet in diameter. The hoop glowed like blue neon. Silently he positioned the ring above my head and lowered it slowly to the floor. As it passed around my body, it seemed to shed a cocoon of light behind. I saw myself in the mirror, encased in a cylinder of blue haze. "Now we wait," Michael said, "to let the energy soak in." He cocked his head, looking me up and down as he groped himself inside his nylon briefs. His dark, handsome face went slack with lust, lips parted, eyes narrowed, sexed up. I felt the hair on my body stand up straight as if charged with static electricity. Something weird was happening in the mirror. I saw a mass of suspended particles in the space between my body and the cocoon of blue light, too vague to make out in the mirror. I tried to look down. My neck was paralyzed. Michael saw me straining. He reached inside the light and pushed my face down. My body had been stripped of its hair. The process was silent, painless. Magic, I suppose. The short hairs detached themselves from my skin and drifted slowly through the light-suffused air, made contact with the field of circling blue light, and disappeared. At first the air was choked with free-floating strands, silky yellow ones from my chest and arms and legs, kinky darker ones from my crotch. Then the migration grew sparser, until I saw the last curly strand unfurl from my left nipple, stand straight, and pull free. It wafted gently like a weightless mote of dust, drew steadily toward the barrier of light, touched it, vanished.
Afterward. This is Susie Bright again, the editor of the Best American Erotica series and the curator of this special collection of erotic stories with a gay man's perspective, or perhaps I should say men who appreciate other men's sexual potential to its full extent. These authors and their stories are not only my favorites, they're also pieces that seem to linger in the memories of BAE's thousands of devoted fans. If you're not familiar with the Best American Erotica series, which ran from 1993 to 2008, you may be wondering, what is this woman editor doing, picking out gay fiction? Is she some sort of super faghead? What are her qualifications? Well, I'd love to tell you the whole behind-the-scenes story. It started in 1993 when I got a phone call from the publisher of the venerated series Best American Poetry, Mark Chimsky at Scribner. He asked me if I'd like to helm a new series called The Best American Erotica. He mentioned that his colleagues had told him that I knew more about erotic lit than anyone else in the world. Well, I told him, if that was true, as flattering as it was, I would like to enlarge that group. Great literature with deep, frank sexual stories should be part of every reader's repertoire. At the time, I was neck-deep in small press gay and lesbian publishing as well as theater and film, and I had a decade's experience of putting out groundbreaking erotic fiction by women, like the Erotica series as well as the lesbian sex magazine On Our Backs. I'd also been an innovator in covering sex cinema, both in front of and behind the camera, where I found that the gay side of the business led everyone on all fronts, aesthetically and technologically. Where gay porn goes the so-called straight side. I'd been thinking for years that as much as I liked breaking stereotypes about women's sexual timidity, I would really love to have an occasion to publish the great erotic writing by men that came across my desk every day. These men were my comrades in arms. They had mentored me in my own erotic work, and I couldn't imagine a life in the erotic arts without them. They included great people from the talent well of Drummer magazine, like John Roberry, John Preston, Jack Fritcher. Those were my holy trinity of gay porn daddies. All three of these men were not only amazing writers themselves, but also English literature gurus of the first water. I said to Mark Chimpsky at Scribner, you know, I love this idea. I'm so flattered and excited you asked me, but we have to get one thing clear. If I do this series, I'm going to take the title seriously. It will be the very best erotic writing of the year, no matter who writes it or what the subject is, without fear or favor. And that means stories about men loving men, fucking men, the entire world of male sexuality. I knew that Scribner was going to publish Best American Erotica for a very wide, broad audience. It was going to be in airport bookstores, mainstream bookstores. It wasn't going to be a plain brown wrapper novel. And some of those mainstream readers might be naive or frightened about things they didn't understand. There would be readers who are so used to everything being out of Playboy magazine that they would be shocked by a queer sex story. There would undoubtedly be homophobes. But with a title like Best American Erotica, I couldn't hold my head up or have any kind of credibility if I excluded gay content. Luckily for me, my editor, Mark, was an out-of-the-closet gay editor, highly educated and a literature-savvy pro, and he agreed with me. It was 1993, for God's sake. He was not afraid, and I was so grateful, because I was dying to get this series off the ground, and I knew that most editors I'd spoken to before were terrified of the subject, terrified of the backlash. They felt like it would reflect on them personally. So, we were off to the races. And I have to tell you, there were many years where it was hard for me to find any so-called straight heterosexual stories to match the number of gay candidates who were superlative. Now, why is that? I'm really not a homosexual superiorist. There is a history to this. First of all, among authors and in great drama and comedy, there isn't such a thing as gay and straight to begin with. You tell the truth, you tell it well, and let the chips and the bodies fall where they may. I never do panty checks with my authors. I have gay authors like Michael Thomas Ford, who has written prize-winning lesbian literature. And I've known women to write gay men stories that are absolute classics, like how about Brokeback Mountain? I have very vanilla women friends who write hardcore leather gay SM under a pseudonym. The authors don't care. They want to write what compels them, and some of them are very, very good at it. Furthermore, readers don't just want to read about their narrow little lives. As reading people, we gobble up stories about great adventures and characters that have nothing to do with anything we've witnessed in our own lives. It's the same with sex. If someone writes a truly classic sex story, it is classic because it resounds with everyone. And if it's a niche story with great craft and insight, it will find readers far beyond its narrative milieu. In the great legal battles of the American 1950s, when writers and editors were first trying to break the sex barriers in American publishing, we had authors like Henry Miller, Jean Genet, titles like Pauline Réage's Story of O, who were fighting for years to get their work published unexpurgated in the American market. That fight was led by queer and sexually bohemian publishers. They wouldn't rest. There was this tradition. And you can take it all the way back to Oscar Wilde or Rambeau or Baudelaire. Sexually avant-garde writing was something that was promoted by men of highly educated taste, a bank account to back it up, and an appreciation of men's sexuality and love for each other. Honestly, I wish there had been a similar monetary and brain trust like this for women. But except among a few aristocrats, it was impossible because of women's lack of property rights and civil rights. By the time I joined Scribner to publish BAE, there was a long and thriving tradition of gay men's presses, both magazines and books, that ranged from the incandescently smutty Boyd McDonald comes to mind, to crossover artists like Edmund White, Gore Vidal. In between was incredible range and talent, which was probably most spectacularly shown off in the 1990s by a series called Flesh and the Word that was edited by John Preston and then Michael Lowenthal. That was an anthology I hope to record on audio. The fact that gay erotic writing reached its commercial zenith at the very moment that AIDS entered our community and the same moment that technology changed our sex habits forever is a fascinating twist of fate. Let me tell you a little bit about some of the stories you've been listening to in this volume. The first story in our volume is by Samuel Delaney, a Hugo Nebula Award winner who's a household name in science fiction, but also a giant in gay erotic literature. I remember how pleased I was to meet him for the very first volume of Best American Erotica in 1993. Later in 96, I met another giant, Stephen Saylor, who's known for his Roman period historical fiction, but under his gay porn nom de plume, Aaron Travis, he has written stories like The Hit that we're listening to here today and also the last story in the volume, Blue Light. I think those two are classic erotic stories that transcend any sexual preference. I remember at the end of my series, I did a poll among the readers. What was the best story of hundreds that you've read? And most of the people who answered, you know, it included straight people, bi people, tons of women. The Hit won by a landslide. After you listen to it, I'm sure you'll be ready to mark your ballot too. Another name you may recognize from our hit parade is Lars Einar, who had a huge New York Times bestseller called Travels with Lisbeth, Lisbeth being his beloved dog. But Lars has written every genre of fiction, including erotica. And I loved his fantasy story here, The Trade. Another story I know I really enjoyed is Adam McCabe's work, The Maltese Dildo. This is a fantastic retelling of The Maltese Falcon, and I only wish Humphrey Bogart was still alive to enjoy it. One thing I really loved about the stories I read for Best American Erotica were all the newcomers I found telling stories about lives that had been completely unrecorded. I'm thinking of Ernie Conrick's story, The Queen of Exit 17, which is about bathroom sex on the highways connecting New Jersey to New York. I mean, turnpike restrooms. No one has ever talked about the great romances on these highways and byways, and his story is so memorable to me in that respect. Another one I loved is called Sunday by Dan Taluapapa McMullen, which is a story about being a Samoan American, a teenager, and being raised proper in a very conservative Christian church where maybe the pastor and his family aren't all what they seem. There were great stories about our generation in this collection. I know that Michael Bronski, his piece on Dr. Fell and its implications about Vietnam vets and what happens to men who love men after a war, I found deeply moving. We have Charles Flowers talking about what it's like to be a man who loves another man who works in the boxing ring. We have great stories about the height of the drug-intoxicated days before the great crash in a story by Gary Rosen called Champagne Tastes on a Crystal Budget. I know I like saying that phrase all the time. And I had to wrap up the collection with a British writer, Sean Levin, who tells the story of a one-night stand called The Whole Bloody Story of My Life from Beginning to End. Another author who I think looms large in American popular culture is Nelson George, who writes a story about the elite basketball player set in New York called It's Never Too Late in New York. And I always think when Nelson writes about sex, he says so much that he doesn't talk about anywhere else in his writing about the sports world or popular culture or politics. He's at his most vulnerable here. Another writer who I think just changed everything we think about gay writing, about American writing in general, is Dennis Cooper. This particular story that you've listened to today is from a novel he wrote called The Sluts. That would be a great novel to dramatize on audio. It's where he decided to take the technology world of online dating and the kind of reports that Johns post about tricks. And he thought, what if I took that kind of writing where everyone is posting stories about this one particular trick who's driving everyone insane and turned it into a novel? I couldn't put it down. That's just a peek at some of my favorites. It's hard to leave any of them out, but I would look forward to any of your suggestions for future best gay erotica collections.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of Favorite Gay Men's Stories from Best American Erotica, edited by Susie Bright, narrated by a full cast with an introduction and afterword by Susie Bright. Executive Producer, Jennifer Basick. Supervising Producer, Mike Charzik. Producer, Kat Lambrix. The Hit, copyright 1993 by Aaron Travis. An excerpt from Citre et Trans, copyright 1992 by Samuel R. Delaney. The Trade, copyright 1994 by Lars Einar, Clay Caldwell, and Aaron Travis. Indio, copyright 1994 by Al Lusion. The Queen of Exit 17, copyright 1998, by Ernie Comrick. Pre-Dahmer, copyright 1994, by Track Vu. The Maltese Dildo, copyright 1998, by Adam McCabe. Apuja to Ganesha, copyright 1996, by Simon Shepherd. Semen in a Bullet, copyright 2001, by Alex Buckman and Steve Zeeland. Spurt, copyright 1997, by Kevin Killian. Champagne Tastes on a Crystal Budget, copyright 2000, by Gary Rosen. Dr. Fell, copyright 1997, by Michael Bronsky. Calcutta, copyright 1998, by Bob Vickery. Sink, copyright 1999, by Matthew Bernstein Sycamore. Sunday, copyright 1998, by Dan Taulapapa McMullen. Queer Punk, copyright 1996, by Bob Vickery. That's Awful, That's Nothing, copyright 1999, by Wade Kruger. In This Corner, copyright 1999, by Charles Flowers. The Whole Bloody Story of My Life from Beginning to End, copyright 2000, by Sean Levin. In Deep, copyright 2000, by Simon Shepherd. It's Never Too Late in New York, copyright 2003, by Nelson George. High Risk, copyright 2004, by Bob Vickery. An excerpt from The Sluts, copyright 2005, by Dennis Cooper. Blue Light, copyright 1980, by Stephen Saylor. Production copyright 2012, by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.